Campus FM presents Classic Texts, produced by Vicky Spiteri, presented by Margaret Ajus.
Hello and welcome to Classic Texts. In this series, we are presenting a light-footed journey through a number of English literature texts and their authors, with the help of select guests who will give us short commentaries on the works in question. Today's program is focusing on Dracula by Bram Stoker, a dark and horrific tale of ancient evil and supernatural power. Stoker transfers man's evil to his character Count Dracula, who maintains his immortality by draining blood out of his victims. First published in 1897, the novel Dracula by Irish author Bram Stoker has never been out of print. It has been reissued in over 300 editions, including dozens in foreign languages. The figure of Count Dracula has dominated 20th century culture. The novel has had numerous adaptations and films. That a single novel, given only scant attention at the time of publication, should have had such an impact is nothing short of phenomenal. English solicitor Jonathan Harker arrives in Transylvania to meet Count Dracula, who has asked him to purchase property in England. Harker realizes that in the grim and ruined castle he is being hosted in, live vampires, ruled by Dracula, who descends the castle walls face down like a bat, who seem to appear from nowhere in Harker's room, and who has imprisoned him in a castle full of bolted doors and windows. Harker escapes narrowly. Back in England, Jonathan's wife Mina visits her friend Lucy. During this visit, a violent storm hits Whidbey and wrecks a ship. The crew is dead, but a box on board containing Dracula lands safely. Lucy starts to sleepwalk and shows red marks on her neck. Meanwhile, a particular patient in a nearby asylum makes an unusual disturbance. Lucy falls ill in a way which mystifies everyone, and her friends and suitors send for Abraham van Helsing, a renowned Dutch doctor. Alarmed at Lucy's anemic condition, he gives her blood transfusions, but Lucy dies. Van Helsing warns that she is not truly dead, for she has herself become a vampire. Van Helsing, together with her suitors, go to her grave, where they drive a stake through her heart to give her eternal rest. Mina is also attacked by Dracula, before he flees back to Transylvania, followed closely by Van Helsing and his followers, then also joined by Harker. In the final conflict, Dracula's power is finally destroyed.
Professor Van Helsing, how good of you to come.
I always come to my friends in need when they call me. So, Jack, tell me everything about your case.
She has all the usual physical anemic signs.
Yeah?
Her blood analyze is normal, and yet it is not. She manifests continued blood loss. I can't trace the cause.
Blood loss? How?
I...
My God, close the door! God, she's only a child. Yeah. My God. There's no time to be lost. Must be a transfusion at once. Take off your coat. Remember how to tie a tourniquet, don't you? Or have you forgotten?
You perfected a procedure?
Perfected? No. I've only experimented. Landsteiner's method. Animals, goats, sheep. Hemolysis occurs in the blood on the serum. Her red blood cells will explode. She will die. Here, take this tube.
What in God's name is going on up here?
This is Professor Van Helsing, Art.
Well, what the hell is he doing to Luce? He's trying to save her life.
Good God. You're the fiancé? Please. Please. Take off your coat. This young lady is very ill. She's dying. She wants blood, and blood she must have. Take off your coat.
Roll up your sleeve, Art.
Oh, God. Roll it up.
This may hurt a little, Art. Forgive me, sir. My life is hers. I would give my last drop of blood to save her.
Your last drop? Thank you. You're very welcome here. I do not ask as much as that. Not yet.
Hold her hand.
But, Jack, that poor creature has had the blood of two men put into her already.
Man alive. Her whole body couldn't hold that much blood.
What took it out?
It's a good question, Mr. Morris.
Those marks on her throat. No disease, no trituration. I'm sure the blood loss occurred there.
Oh? Where did the blood go? You were once a careful student, Jack. Use your brain. Where did the blood go? Tell me.
The Bettlers would be covered in blood.
Exactly. You do not let your eyes see nor your ears hear that which you cannot account for.
Something just went up there, sucked it out of her, and flew away, I suppose.
Yeah? Why not?
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. Will one of you learned doctors or whatever you are kindly tell me what is going on with my Lucy?
Jack, you are a scientist. Do you not think there are things in this universe which you cannot understand and which are true? Mesmerism, hypnotism,
you and Shark electromagnetic fields. Professor, I feel like a blundering novice.
Gentlemen, we're not fighting some disease here. Those marks in your dear Miss Lucy's neck were made by something unspeakable out there. Dead, but not dead. It stalks us for some dread purpose I do not yet comprehend. To live, it feeds on Lucy's precious blood. It is a beast, a monster.
Abraham Stoker was born on the 8th of November 1847 in Dublin into a comfortable family. His mother was a pioneering feminist writer and a friend of Oscar Wilde's mother. Graham was a sickly child for many years. As he lay on his sickbed, his mother would tell him tales of ghouls, ghosts and demons, some inspired by Irish folklore. He eventually overcame his illness, and in 1864 he entered Trinity College to study mathematics. Here he also developed his intellectual and literary interests. In 1870 he started working in the Court of Petty Summons, a job he supplemented by reviewing plays, and in 1871 he became drama critic of the Dublin Mail. In 1876, Stoker befriended Henry Irving and 2 years later, he took on the management of Irving's theatre, the Lyceum. There is little doubt that his continuous exposure to the world of theatre found its way into his acclaimed novel, which lends itself so well to stage adaptation. In December 1878, Stoker married an aspiring actress, Florence Balcombe, and had a child. From 1880, he began to write and publish short stories. His first full-length novel, The Snake's Pass, appeared in 1890. In 1897, he wrote Dracula. Although by no means the first English novel about vampires, it was by far the most chilling. It achieved moderate success and was one of the first novels to be published in paperback. Stoker produced 15 novels and many other works, but none of these had the success of Dracula. Stoker's health, never strong, was undermined by years of overwork, and he collapsed and died suddenly of exhaustion on April 20th, 1912. The historical Dracula was a 15th century Romanian prince better known to historians as Vlad the Impaler. He was a cruel warrior, and his penchant for impaling his victims on spikes won him a place in terror legends. And what about Transylvania? This region has become synonymous with Dracula and vampires, much of the puzzlement of people who live there. Stoker situated his story in Transylvania, which means the land beyond the forest, seemingly because he was intrigued by this part of Eastern Europe's superstitions, including beliefs in vampires. But Dracula is much more than a vampire from Transylvania who comes to England for nourishment. It is a Gothic tale of the Victorian legacy. The vampire epitomizes, for many, the breaking of taboos, the challenge of authority, the fine line between power and passion, the search for immortality and eternal youth. The novel explores Victorian concerns with gender, sexuality and religion. It provides a window through which we can view fin de siècle fears. Count Dracula poses many threats to Victorian social, moral, and political values. He is a foreigner who threatens to invade England. He is the embodiment of evil that can only be destroyed by reasserting the beliefs of traditional Christianity in an increasingly skeptical and secular age. He represents the fear of regression, a reversal of evolution, a return to a primal animal state. How does its plot, its bleak ambience, and its dark characters contribute towards the understanding of these anxieties?
Dracula, as you said, poses threats to the Victorian status quo. These are threats which are intrinsic to the Victorian Gothic. There are elements which make Dracula different than others. There are those elements which serve to reassess changing Victorian preoccupations and values. Count Dracula is both demon and demon lover. He is aristocratic yet bestial. He confers immortality, but he corrupts the soul. He simultaneously fascinates and repulses. His supernatural qualities are inviolable, yet threatening to a culture which oscillates between scientific progress and unparalleled belief in the pseudosciences. And he's a foreigner, bent on moving to London to feed on its steaming millions. Bram Stoker's famous novel, translated into dozens of languages, is definitely a masterpiece of its time. And it could perhaps be argued that it could not have been written, say, 50 years earlier, which would have situated it in the Romantic period. It's because Dracula itself helped create the climate for its popular and critical reception, as well its own timeliness, after which, of course, it became timeless. It was instrumental in creating both a literary archetype as well as a cultural icon, and it served to feed and address those Victorian fears and desires which, till the late 1800s, had remained relatively dormant or been suppressed. Stoker's novel, therefore, could not have arrived at a more propitious time. Mesmerism, which Abraham Van Helsing makes use of in his attempt to create a telepathic link between Mina Murray and the vampire, had already been in use since the 1830s. Even Dickens himself shown a keen interest in the phenomenon. Several breakthroughs in medicinal and natural science were also made during this intensely rich period. The theory of evolution, the discovery of genetic inheritance, the periodic table of elements in chemistry, the attribution of decay to bacterial cause, as well as the achievement of successful results in blood transfusion, which Van Helsing also makes use of in his attempt to save Lucy Westenra's life. Moreover, in 1897, the year of Dracula's publication, Sigmund Freud had also started research into psychoanalysis, which of course bears distinct affinities with the various subtexts present in the vampire novel. Chief among them is the eroticism thinly veiled, for which Dracula remains famous. Indeed, on a note written by Stoker in 1890 as part of his research material, we find the germ of an idea which would later link vampirism with eroticism. Stoker writes, "Young man goes out, sees girls, one tries to kiss him, not on the lips but throat. Old count interferes, rage and fury, diabolical." This is later translated to one of the most memorable episodes in the novel. It is the one where Jonathan Harker experiences some longing and some deadly fear when visited by the count succubi. All three had brilliant white teeth that shone like pearls against the ruby of their voluptuous lips. I felt in my heart a wicked, burning desire that they would kiss me with those red lips. I could feel a soft, shivering touch of the lips on the super-sensitive skin of my throat, and the hard dents of two sharp teeth. I closed my eyes in a languorous ecstasy and waited with beating heart. Scholars of the literary vampire genre excel at noting subversions to hierarchy, sexuality, and power relationships with Dracula. From Dracula's phallic extensions present in the alligator teeth to a conscious desire of being penetrated on behalf of the victim. Critic Nina Auerbach has also noted that flirts like Lucy Westenra become even more virtuous after death than when alive, confining themselves to satisfying the lust of one man, and not many. "Come to me, Arthur. Leave those others and come to me. My arms are hungry for you. Come and we can rest together." Others like James B. Twitchell read in Dracula Freud's treatment of the father figure who subjugates weaker males by possessing and hoarding their women. In Freud's Totem and Taboo, the weaker males would have had to overthrow the dominant male both to assert their sexuality as well as to prolong their genetic line. Twitchell believes this is essentially what drives the lynching mob led by Van Helsing to murder Dracula by the end of the novel. He is not simply an evil force to be reckoned with, but a threat to Victorian sexual complacency and a threat to British racial blood. Indeed, he says, "Flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood, kin of my kin. This is Dracula, which gloats after feasting on the helpless Mina. This precarious sexuality is therefore savagely asserted when Arthur Holmwood penetrates his wife with hammer and stake, while we are told her body shook and quivered and twisted in wild contortions. By mid-novel, it is therefore quite apparent that the lust for blood, which is the vampire's main prerogative, has been unconsciously transferred onto his hunters. How conscious or not Stoker was when he established a new convention in the vampire genre, the blood rite, remains conjectural, yet the words, "the blood is the life," haunt us to this day. Stoker consciously subverted the biblical rite of the Holy Communion, that much is evident. He also was the first to allow an exchange of body fluids between the vampire and his prey, suggesting an intimacy which is erotically carnal and yet corrupt. This exchange of blood was only rendered less darker and purer in the vampire lovers of Anne Rice. For the Victorian public, however, it hinted at darker desires and spiritual disease of communing with the Antichrist. Vampire, beast, Antichrist, or simply an allegorical extension of our subconscious fears, Dracula remains an enduring literary and filmic icon, principally because of his flexible attributes. He is, after all, a shapeshifter. He is also a repository of opposites, at once something monstrous, but also something human, playing on our fears of death and seducing us with the promise of immortality, enabling us to entertain notions of the real as well as the fantastic. And while being a general pain in the neck, he remains very much embedded in the collective psyche of the 21st century. His promise of immortality, at least in literary terms, has been realized. Conrad Aquilino.
Abraham Stoker did not invent the vampire. Vampires appear in the folklore and legends of many cultures, dating back to ancient times. Interest in the English-speaking world can be traced back to 1732, when the word vampire first appeared in our language. The occasion was a rash of vampire sightings reported and documented in several parts of Central and Eastern Europe, and eventually reported in the British press. These were so widespread that in some countries government officials became directly involved, as did the academic community and such leading figures of the Enlightenment as Diderot and Voltaire. The attention given to vampirism coincided with, and maybe contributed to, a rising interest in Gothic literature, first in Germany and later in England. It was inevitable that the vampire from the realm of folklore would be adopted by Gothic writers. The first in English literature to do so were poets, notably Robert Southey and Lord Byron. But the most important contribution came from an unlikely source, Lord Byron's personal physician, John Polidori. As a result of the novel, the conventions were firmly in place and are now, thanks to the proliferation of Dracula movies, known by virtually everyone. The vampire is of an old aristocratic and usually foreign family. The vampire is tall, dark, spectral, and dressed in black. The vampire possesses sharp fangs, which leave two bite marks on the victim. The vampire is a creature of unusual physical strength. The vampire has a strong seductive power over women. The victim's response to the vampire is ambivalent, revealing both attraction and repulsion. The vampire has the ability to shapeshift into animal form, especially wolves and bats, to enter as mist, to glide through a crack. He casts no shadow and has no reflection in a mirror. He cannot enter a home unless he is invited in. He is repelled by garlic and by holy objects. He must sleep in his native soil, and he can be destroyed if a wooden stake is driven through his heart. Though the first film adaptation was the German Nosferatu in 1922, it was Universal Studios' 1931 production that ensured Dracula his immortality. Based on a Broadway stage production, the film starred Bela Lugosi, whose voice and physical appearance, though very unlike that of the Count in the novel, shaped the image for the 20th century. This movie has been followed by countless adaptations which continue into the present decade. Some very prominent actors have played in Dracula movies. Christopher Lee, Louis Jordan, Jack Palance, Sir Laurence Olivier, Frank Langella, Gary Oldman, Anthony Hopkins, and of course, Mel Brooks. Movies based on Dracula tend to wander considerably from the original text, to the point sometimes where the story is unrecognizable. Perhaps the most faithful adaptation was the BBC TV production of 1978, starring Louis Jordan as the Count. And we have come to the end of another programme, Classic Texts. Audio clips for this programme were taken from the 1992 adaptation by Francis Ford Coppola, starring Gary Oldman as Dracula. Credits go to Talking Classics and to the AV Library at the CCT University of Malta. Join us next week for another programme in the series.
You have just listened to Classic Texts, produced by Vicky Spiteri, presented by Margaret Ajus.